preach this meeting to you. Been excited about it for a good while, once I remembered it. I keep my life together in my calendar on my phone, and I had to get a new phone, and hence my calendar was messed up, and so I remember the conversation we had about getting things ready, and then, oh, when was it? January, February, something like that. You just sent a Facebook message and you said, "Hey, I need a bio for the meeting that's upcoming." I said, "Meeting? Oh, yeah." And I'm glad that you sent that little reminder. See, we preachers do that. You know, you didn't have to say, "I'm reminding you about the meeting." You just said, "I need a bio for your meeting." And that's a good indication. Remember the meeting? And so after that, put up my phone. We are ready to go. As you can see up here, we're going to be talking about practical studies from the book of Revelation. When you hear Revelation, the book of Revelation, many people automatically get intimidated, number one, or number two, very intrigued because they think it's going to be some kind of fanciful study about all sorts of, you know, end times type things like what you see in popular culture. But really, Revelation is not as fanciful as you might think. And it's not as far out as you might think. The book of Revelation was intended to encourage a group of first century Christians, and by extension to encourage us and to edify us and prepare us for the troubles that life hands us. So Revelation really is quite practical. And as I was thinking about what to do for this meeting, I thought, you know, we're studying through the book of Revelation. I've had a chance, and you don't often get this chance. I've been in Hebron now 15, going on 16 years, and about 4 or 5 years ago, maybe 3 or 4, I taught through Revelation in Bible class, and then I had an overwhelming request when we began our new study a few quarters ago to go through it again. And so I'd gone through it just a few years before, and now I'm going through it again. And to me, that's very beneficial because it's still fresh, but now I get to revisit it. And as I was going through, I saw things in sort of a new perspective in terms of the practicality of the book of Revelation. So that's what we're going to talk about throughout this gospel meeting series. And we're going to try to go in order of the chapters, you know, in terms of what we're talking about. We're not going to hit everything. But in particular, in these first 4 or 5 chapters, the first several sermons you're going to hear are going to come from those first several chapters. We're going to start in chapter 1. And what we're going to talk about, I was hoping that this thing would work as a clicker. Obviously, that's not the case. Let's see if that's going to work. Now, I'll have to buy a clicker at some point. My clicker died on me, and so I'll take care of that at some point. We're going to talk about Jesus as he's depicted in the Revelation. Who is Jesus? Today, people's view of God is skewed. We were talking just a moment ago about authority, about the breakdown of the family unit. One of the byproducts of that is people don't really understand who God is. I know Jay Leno used to go out on the street and ask random questions and get kind of a poll of what people thought about, you know, what color is the White House? Or very simple questions that people had strange answers to. If you go out and you ask people, who is God? The answers you get are going to be varied, and many of them are going to be incorrect. Same is true with Jesus Christ. Who is Jesus Christ? It's no mistake that God begins Revelation by revealing the Savior. This is who Jesus is. And so what we're going to do is we're going to look at the first chapter, and we're going to find out some things about Jesus. And we're just going to go through some characteristics, and I invite your discussion, your comments. I wanted to treat this like a Bible class this morning for the Bible class session. If you have something to say, that'd be great. I might call on somebody to read. If you want to read, that would be lovely. And let's try to have some interaction here if we can. First of all, the voice of Jesus. Let's look at Revelation chapter 1 and verse number 10. Now, we're going to talk about John and some of the situations there in the first part of chapter 1 a little bit later in one of our other sermons. But look at the end of verse 10. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day and heard behind me a great voice as of a trumpet. You know, as I was preparing this lesson, I kept asking myself, what would it be like to see this part of Jesus or to hear Jesus? What would it be like to hear the voice of Jesus? What do you think his voice sounds like? I have a good friend, Robert Jeffries. Many of you remember Robert Jeffries. He was at the Smyrna congregation. Maybe you heard him preach. He has this deep, preacherly voice. And, you know, people always used to say, I love to hear him speak. It's because he's got kind of that velvety voice. I don't know that that's what Jesus' voice would have sounded like. I don't know. But I know that as it's depicted here in chapter 1, it was a great voice. And verse 10 says, as of a trumpet. You jump down to verses 15 and 16. After it says, his feet like unto fine brass, they burned in a furnace. His voice as the sound of many waters. Anybody here ever been to Niagara Falls? You have? What does it sound like?
Roar.
Could you hear yourself talk to someone beside you? No, it's so, the magnitude of that sound is staggering. You know, I do woodworking. You turn on a planer, the sound of a planer as you're putting wood through that planer. Very loud, okay? Imagine not just the sound of Niagara Falls, but the sound of many Niagara Falls. That's the picture here. When Jesus speaks, you can't help but hear. And you can't help but listen. Jesus didn't have some mousy little voice that did not demand our respect and did not demand our attention. In fact, in Matthew 7 and verse 29, the people who heard him speak says he taught as one who had what? Authority, and not as the scribes. When Jesus stood up to speak, his voice demanded attention. And everyone listened, even those who disagreed, even those who wanted him dead, they could not help but listen, because his was the voice as many waters. And so he had a voice that commanded respect and commanded attention. Verse 16 says, out of his mouth went a sharp two-edged sword. You remember that from Hebrews 4:12, right? The word of God is quick, sharper than a two-edged sword, piercing even to the dividing center, soul, spirit, joints, and marrow, and is a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart. Two-edged sword. What's the significance of a two-edged sword?
That's both ways.
Okay. I've heard several explanations of that, and they're all accurate in some way or another, you know. Cuts both ways, positive and negative aspect of the gospel. The gospel can bring people together, or as Jesus said, I came not to bring peace, but a sword. The gospel can divide, because if someone chooses not to follow it, then it can cause division. It can save us or cause us to be lost. The words that I speak unto you, the same will judge you in the last day. John 12:48. And so the Word of God has cutting power, positively and negatively. And when Jesus speaks, His words force us to make a decision. Am I going to obey? Am I going to follow or not? Jesus' voice, like a trumpet, like the sound of many waters. Number two, the nature of Jesus. We see this statement a lot in Revelation. I am the Alpha and Omega. That, of course, is the first and last letter of the Greek alphabet. And I was in Greek class in preaching school, and I learned something that I've never practiced since then. It's not Alpha. It's Alpha. My wife was in Greek class with me, and our Greek instructor said that Danielle spoke Greek like Willie Nelson. Like Willie Nelson's grandma. That's right. That's even worse. And he was very particular about the pronunciation. It's Alpha. There is no I in Greek, he said. But you and I know it as Alpha and Omega. He's the first letter and the last letter of the alphabet. We would say today he is A and Z. What does that mean? Well, it means that Jesus was the beginning and was before the beginning. You know, it's interesting. If you talk to certain denominations, some of them believe that Jesus is a created being. And as such, he was created at the creation. But that's not true. In the beginning was the Word. In the beginning, the Word was already there. It goes on to say in John 1, all things were made by Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made. Jesus was present at and before the beginning. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. In fact, the Jehovah's Witnesses even mistranslate John 1 in an attempt to make it look like Jesus was a created being. Okay, they call him a little g God in John chapter 1. And that's certainly not the case. He was at and before the beginning. Colossians 1:17 says He is before all things. Listen to that. He is before all things. And it also says, and by him all things consist. Jesus is the reason everything continues, and he's the reason it's here to begin with. He was before the beginning. Jesus Christ was eternal. You and I are eternal. We have a soul that will live forever. But we're not eternal the same way Jesus is. We were created. There was a point when you and I did not exist. There's never been a point where Jesus Christ did not exist. He was before the beginning, and he will be here after the end. So shall we ever be with the Lord. Alpha and Omega, the first and the last. How long did you say I had?
Till 45.
Till 45. All right, we're doing fine. That clock is right, correct?
Sure.
One of the few places that doesn't put the clock right in front of the preacher, right? You actually don't, you know, it's actually not a plague to me because it's on the side. And it's got the little, you know, the little pendulum there too. So that's pretty nice. So, voice, nature. One of the most interesting aspects of Jesus as you look at it in Revelation chapter 1. If you'll pick up with me here in chapter 1, and let's look at verse number 12. I turned to see the voice that spake with me, and being turned, I saw seven golden candlesticks. It's interesting, if you just Google Revelation and you talk about and you Google the seven candlesticks, one of the first illustrations that'll come to you is a picture of the menorah, which is the candelabra that has the seven things coming out of it, but it's all one candle. All one candlestick with different branches. It's not what's depicted here. What's depicted here is seven individual candlesticks. Now look at verse number 13. In the midst of the seven candlesticks, one like unto the Son of Man, clothed with a garment down to the foot, girt about the paps with a golden girdle. I want you to picture in your head, Revelation is a book of pictures. It's a book of symbols. God is showing this to John, and John is physically seeing it. And what he sees is Jesus surrounded by these seven candlesticks. Bonus question, what do those candlesticks represent?
The churches.
Okay, the churches, okay? Interestingly enough, then, Jesus is in the middle of the seven churches. What in the world would that mean?
They're built around him.
They're built around him. He is the center. What's the most important part of a wheel, especially a spoked wheel? The hub, the middle. Man, if that breaks, you're in trouble, aren't you? You're absolutely in trouble. I saw, maybe it was on television, on like Good Morning America or something one time, a vehicle driving down the road and all four wheels fell off at the same time. Talk about bad luck. It's bad enough to have a flat tire or to have a one tire, you know, fall off. Maybe you went and got some new tires, they forgot to tighten the lug nuts or something like that. All four fall off at the same time. That fella's just not doing something right. Or lady, as it were. Maybe lady. I don't know. I didn't get a chuckle out of that. Danielle usually gives me a dirty look when I talk about lady drivers. But Jesus is in the middle. Why? Because the middle is the most important. Everything else revolves around Jesus as the center of everything. An amazing statement in Philippians chapter 1 and verse 21, for to me to live is Christ. Now, if I ask by a show of hands who's heard that before and is familiar with that verse, everyone would say, you could probably tell me the rest of that in the straight betwixt the two, you know, to go and be with Christ, which is far better, but to be here is more needful for you. You know that whole context. But this is such an amazing statement. For me to live is Christ. What he's doing is essentially setting up a math equation. He says, life equals Christ. Nothing else. To him, life is defined wholly by Jesus Christ. Paul is making a statement that Jesus Christ is the center driving force of everything he does. How many of us can say the same thing? Jesus is at the center of every aspect of my life. I don't go to work and leave my Christianity at home. I don't go home and leave my Christianity at church. Christ is the center of everything I do. For me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. If we live with Christ in the center, death is gain. And that's the point that Paul is making. In Numbers chapter 2, when God commanded them to set up the camp, and this is when they were still wandering or in the wilderness and when they were traveling as a nomadic people, God said, when you set up camp, what's supposed to be in the middle of the camp? The tabernacle is at the middle of the camp. Why? That's where God lives, right? Now we know God dwells not in temples made with hands, but that was a representation of God. And God is to be in the center of the camp everywhere you go. God is to be in the center of our lives everywhere we go. Work, family, recreation, everything we do centers around Christ. For to me to live is Christ. He was in the midst, in the middle of those candlesticks. What about his clothes? Let's continue. Let's pick up in verse 13. In the midst of the seven candlesticks, one like unto the Son of Man, clothed with a garment down to the foot, girt about the paps with a golden girdle. It's interesting. You said last night that if you ran off the road, chances were good you would hit what two institutions?
The nursery and the Church of Christ.
Okay. In Warren County, that's right, correct? In Cannon County, too. That's right. Are we in Cannon County?
We're in Cannon County.
Okay. It's saying, you know, it's not too much difference. You know, Warren County might be the nursery capital of the world, but it's kind of spilled over into the surrounding counties also. So you're likely to hit a nursery and a Church of Christ, and that's true, and those aren't bad things, which means if I ask how many of you have ever worked in a nursery, how many of you raise your hand? Well, that's a low percentage considering that we're in the nursery capital of the world. You know, at Hebron, how many of you worked in a nursery? Just about every one of them raises their hands. At some point, they've pulled bushes and they've, you know, made cuttings and done those types of things in their lives. But the reason I'm saying that is if you've done hard manual labor, you know there's certain kinds of clothes you don't wear when you go out there. You don't want to wear long flowing clothes that you're going to step on. You know, you want to wear clothes, you don't mind getting dirty. I was not a farmer growing up, but I had lots of friends who were, and it's interesting. They, even when it was hot, a lot of times they'd wear long sleeves because you get sweaty and it can keep you cooler because the wetness of your clothing and the air, you know, it can. They said, I'm just cooler like that. And they didn't dress like a cowboy, they dressed like a worker. Okay? Now, here's what's interesting about that. Here's why I say that. Jesus is clothed with a garment down to the foot. If you go back to Genesis 37 and you remember, what did Joseph's father give him as a symbol of his love for him? Anybody remember? Okay, King James says a coat of many colors. It's interesting, many commentators believe that that's not accurate as to what it was. The word might indicate that it was a long, flowing garment. And here's why that's interesting. If you're out working in the fields, do you want a long, flowing garment? No. You don't want to drag it through the mud, do you? You don't want to step on it. Now, I can't imagine working in a nursery wearing this long robe and every time you bend down, your sleeve gets caught on a bush. Right? What's interesting about that is giving Joseph a long flowing garment indicated he wasn't going to be one of the menial workers in the field. He was going to be in charge. That's really the problem. Joseph was among the youngest of the children, and he was placed in charge of all the older brothers. And they hated it, and they despised him for it, and they eventually tried to kill him for it. Jesus wearing this long flowing garment, that's indicative of the fact that he's in charge. Now, Jesus was tempted in all points like as we are, so he got his hands dirty, so to speak, too. But Jesus is in charge. The long flowing garment is a symbol of authority. It's a sign that he is in command. Okay, and we might not recognize that as we read through, but the first century audience would have seen Jesus in their minds and said, he is in charge. And then he's got the golden belt. The girdle is a belt. Because if you're wearing a long flowing garment, the last thing you want to do is either fly open or drag. And so you have to gather it around. And you would cinch it with one of these belts or girdles. Both of these indicate high rank, command. What John is seeing is a Savior with a booming voice. Seeing a Savior who is in command of everything around him. He is in charge. And that's the picture being painted of Jesus. And that's the picture that will continue. Jesus later on in the vision in Revelation rides in on what? A white horse with a crown and a sword. Authority, command. He's in charge. Jesus Christ is never depicted as he's often depicted in popular culture. And we'll get into that in just a moment. He is a man of power and authority. In fact, is that Jesus?
Good Lord.
Why isn't that Jesus? Tell me all the reasons that's not Jesus. Okay.
Do we know what Jesus looked like today?
I mean, not technically. But I can tell you probably wasn't that.
He would have been darker skinned, being of Jewish
descent. Yeah, he would be in Middle Eastern descent and of Jewish descent. Certainly that would be the case. That looks like a kind of a European hippie kind of fellow, doesn't it? What do his eyes indicate? What do you see in his eyes? Do what? What do you see in his eyes? If you met him on the street, would you be intimidated?
I never depicted him on looking at his lips.
Yeah. He kind of got feminine features here, doesn't he?
He would have had longer hair, probably similar to that.
Yeah, there would have been some similarities. You know, facial hair, he would have had facial hair.
Because they said that was, you know, for women. But he probably had the beard.
Yeah, he went maybe even a bigger beard than that. But olive complexion, feminine features. What are they trying? What kind of Jesus is this? Is he a Jesus of power and authority?
The humble one that loves everybody and the forgiving and, you know.
And all of those attributes are true of Jesus. But are those his only attributes? Remember the song Daddy's Hands? Daddy's hands were what? Soft and kind when I was crying. Daddy's hands were? Hard as steel when I'd done wrong. Which attribute of a father do we need? You need both, right? You need soft and kind when I was crying and hard as steel when I'd done wrong. But God, in popular culture, he's like Santa, right? He just gives us stuff, whether we deserve it or not, right? That's not all the attributes of God. That's not all that he is. This is not all Jesus is. So look at Jesus' face in Revelation. Revelation chapter 1, let's pick up in verse 14. His head and his hairs were white like wool. Okay, well, that doesn't match there. But again, this is figurative, right? He sent and signified it unto his servant John. It means he sent in signs and symbols. Does Jesus really have white hair right now in heaven? Well, God is spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and truth. So he's a spirit being. So we're seeing a representation of Jesus. But in the representation, white hair. Okay? It says his hair was white like wool, as white as snow, and his eyes were milquetoast and girly. His eyes were what in Revelation 1:14? Are those flame of fire eyes? No. But Jesus had eyes like a flame of fire. Now, that's interesting when you compare that to who Jesus is depicted as in the world. You look just in, I can preach a sermon and have before on the eyes of Jesus. For instance, let's just take notes here, okay? For instance, have you ever preached on the eyes of Jesus?
I don't think so.
Take notes. I'm just joking. You know. The eyes of Jesus. When Peter denied Christ, what did Jesus do?
Looked up.
What do you think that was a look of? Was that that look of the guy we just saw a minute ago? It was a look of disappointment, right? Let me just give you just a few instances here. Someone read Mark 3:5. I said I'd ask you to read. Let's go ahead and do that a little bit. Mark 3:5.
Stretched forth thy hand, and he
How did Jesus look around? With anger because of the hardness of their heart. He was grieved and angry.
Is this fella ever angry?
I don't know that dude can get angry, right? What would he do if people mistreated him?
Cry.
Jesus is angry there. He has power. And now it's righteous anger. It's not a situation where Jesus is flying off the handle in an uncontrollable way. But Jesus is powerful, and he's angry when he needs to be. Now Mark 10:21.
Then Jesus, beholding him, loved him, and said unto him, One thing thou lackest, go thy way, sell whatsoever thou hast, and give to the poor, and thou shalt have treasure in heaven, and come, take up the cross, and follow me.
One of the most beautiful passages in the New Testament relative to Jesus. Who is Jesus talking to there? Anybody know? We call him what? The rich young ruler. And the rich young ruler came and he said, what do I have to do that I can follow you? And Jesus said, have you obeyed the law? And he said, oh, I've kept that from my youth up. And then Mark's account says, and it's the only one that says this, Jesus beholding him, loved him. Jesus looked at him and what was in his eyes? But was it a love that excused failure? That excused shortcoming? It was a love that said, you've done so many wonderful things, but you lack one thing that is very important. Go and sell what you have and give it to the poor, then come and take up your cross, follow me. Jesus' eyes. Wouldn't you love to be able to see Jesus' eyes? I mean, actually see them. To be present in the first century, to look at Jesus. How many people, though, looked in those eyes and did not respond properly? How could you do that? I don't understand. The eyes of Jesus. So I'm going to read 1 Corinthians 1:24, then we'll move on to the next point about Jesus' wisdom represented by that white hair, white like snow.
1 unto them which are called both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God.
Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. Christ is the embodiment of God's power and wisdom. Christ is the embodiment of wisdom. Who is the wisest person ever to live? Solomon. Okay. But you've got to excuse one person in order to say that. Jesus Christ. Wisdom embodied in Jesus Christ. The face of Jesus. Wisdom and power. Feet of Jesus. You continue in Revelation 1:15. His feet like unto fine brass, as if they burn in a furnace. Two aspects of Jesus' feet. Number one, they're like fine brass, indicating strength and power, destructive ability. But not just fine brass, but fine brass in what condition? He continues to say, as if it burned in a furnace. It's like that brass was just removed from the forger's fire. So it's blazing hot brass feet. What would those kinds of feet be used for? Tap dancing? Destruction, right? Blazing hot brass feet are used for destruction. He's stomping his enemies. Again, if I put that picture of Jesus that's popularly depicted up on the board, is that the Jesus that would have blazing hot brass feet? No. Jesus is strong, powerful, ready to judge when necessary. Jesus' feet are ready for the judgment that must be meted out. And if I were preaching that sermon on the physical characteristics of Jesus, I would also focus on Jesus' hands. Now go to Revelation 1:16, and his hands are mentioned briefly. And he had in his right hand seven stars. If you were to look at Jesus' hands while he lived upon this earth, what would they look like? Why? It's interesting. And several years ago, there was a youth event in Cumberland Caverns. And some preachers come, and they had this big youth rally type thing in Cumberland Caverns. And I'll never forget this guy spoke, and I can't remember what his topic was, but he said this. He said, when it says that Jesus Christ was a carpenter, we think of a woodworker, right? Because what we usually use to build is wood, right? Because we live in an area where wood is plentiful. What would have been the primary building material in the deserts of Israel?
Stone.
So Jesus, more properly, was a stonemason. What kind of hands would a stonemason have? Man, I mean, carpenter's hands would be rough enough, but stonemason's hands. And he's not using, you know, he doesn't have the newest tile saw, you know, that wet saw where you put things on and just, you know. How is Jesus hewing out that stone? With hand tools, okay? Chisel and hammer. Jesus was a man of power, and you could see it in his hands. There's fellas that I shake their hands. I'm scared to shake their hands, you know? It's like their hands are going to crack open when they move them because and each finger is like the size of my wrist, you know? And they're just, you know that they're going to crush your soul when they shake your hand. I picture Jesus' hands like that. These powerful claws of hands. See, Jesus is not the pushover that he's so often depicted as. Yes, he was a man of love and compassion and mercy. But he's a man of power and conviction, energy, strength. And those, you can't leave the description of Jesus in Revelation 1 without being impressed by that. Jesus is a man of power and dignity and control, authority. And all of those things you see in these descriptions of Jesus Christ. In the time we got left, we've got just about 6 or 7 minutes. We're going to kind of apply all of this and give some lessons. And these three things is what I want to focus on. Number one, Christ is multifaceted. We've touched on this. It's not an either-or proposition with Jesus. You don't either have the hippie who loves everyone or judgment Jesus. He is all of those. He is God, he is God, and as such, he is all love, all mercy, all purity, all judgment, all knowledge, all wisdom. All of those things must be combined. The fundamental problem that people have in religion today is they don't understand who God is and they don't understand who Jesus is. And they have this ill-conceived view of their Savior and their God. We must remind people that the God of the Old Testament is the same as the God of the New Testament. The God you meet in Revelation is not Santa. He's the God of judgment. And we're going to notice that again in a sermon later on today. So Christ is multifaceted. Number two, Christ holds. There's my first typo. Holds. How many of you noticed that already? Okay. Christ holds all authority. Authority begins and ends with Jesus. What statement did Jesus make to begin the Great Commission in Matthew 28? All power hath been given unto me in heaven and earth. Go ye therefore. Everything you and I do is based on the authority of Jesus. People say, well, why don't you have an instrument in worship? Because everything begins and ends with the authority of Jesus. Whatsoever you do in word or deed, what? Do all in the name of or by the authority of Jesus Christ. It's just everything begins and ends with the authority of Jesus Christ. And he has all authority. He claimed all authority. How did he get that authority? He earned it, didn't he? He earned it. It's interesting, the statement, all authority hath been given unto me in heaven and earth, came at what point in Jesus' life? After he had died, been buried, and rose again. He earned all authority. To feed the church of God, Acts 20, which he hath purchased with his own blood. He purchased the authority over the church with the blood that he shed. Christ has all authority. That's why Jesus is the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world in the book of Revelation. He purchased that authority, that right, with his blood. Number 30, Christ is capable for us. Had an instructor, his favorite phrase when it came to Revelation, when it came to other things was, you must read the Bible with first century glasses. What does that mean? Put on some really old spectacles so that you can see better. What does that mean?
Look at it like the eyes of the people back there.
Yes. This was, now, this was written to us in a sense, right? Because we're Christians. Just like Jesus prayed in John 17, neither pray I for these alone, but for all they which may believe on me through their word. Okay? I'm praying not just for the apostles, but for those who believe the words of the apostles. And that's a chain reaction that continues, right? The things which thou hast heard of me among many witnesses, the same commit thou to faithful men who shall be able to teach others also, right? So there's a chain reaction, so to speak. But this was written with a specific audience in mind. What audience was this written to? Okay, the book of Revelation in particular. Yes, more specifically.
The first century Christians.
Who were, what condition were they in?
They were being terribly persecuted by the Roman government.
Okay. Total persecution. This is the greatest persecution the church had ever known. I believe this was written in the 90s AD. It would have been under the reign of Domitian. And it was emperor worship which was plaguing the first century church. And they were horribly persecuted, in particular in the region of Asia where these seven churches were. And so at any moment they could lose their jobs, their families, their freedom, and their lives. And Jesus in Revelation is the Jesus who has power to help, power to deliver, power to encourage and edify and strengthen. That's the Jesus and the God of Revelation. And that's the Jesus and the God that we need now, don't we? I don't know what you all are going through and what you're dealing with in your lives. We can look around at our world and we see problems with our nation. We see problems in our government. We see problems overseas. We see problems in the economy. We need a Jesus who is capable to deliver, capable to help, capable to provide encouragement and strength. And that's the Jesus of Revelation. And the same kinds of troubles that they dealt with on a much smaller scale, you and I deal with. And so that's to me why Revelation is so intensely practical. Because what is the main message of Revelation? It can be stated in two words. We win. That's the book of Revelation. Christians win. We need to hear that from time to time, don't we? You ever feel outnumbered in the world? Up is down and right is wrong sometimes right now, isn't it? And the things that I take for granted, we have a little bit of time. You know, Mike Pence was criticized, and I do not want to get into a political discussion. There are certain foundational principles that all Christians must adhere to, but when it comes to just throwing political discussions out there for the sake of stirring the pot, I don't want to do that. But here's what I'm going to say. Mike Pence was criticized recently because his policy was he was not going to eat alone and meet alone with women. Is that right? Is that Mike Pence? I think it was. To me, that's just good practice. But the feminist movement came out of the woodwork to criticize him. What he's trying to do is protect his marriage and not put himself in a compromising situation. I was taught in preaching school, you don't meet alone with a woman unless somebody else is there present. Why? Not because I think, you know, I'm too weak or women are too, you know, evil. That's not what it's about. It's about not putting yourself in a position where you may compromise. It's about being safe. But when that kind of thing is vilified in our world, man, that's crazy, isn't it? When instead of applauding someone, how many politicians actually care about their marriage today? Let's put that on a list, you know, of things they care about. And you've got one that actually comes out and says, I'm interested in preserving my relationship with my wife, and so I've decided not to have dinner dates alone with women. And instead of being applauded, he's vilified. Up is down and down is up. Woe unto them that call good evil and evil good. Okay, that's what Isaiah said.
Well, so, you know, we have a commandment in the New Testament to abstain from
all appearance of evil. So. You know, and it's hard sometimes to convince people that, you know, the famous last words is, this will never happen to me, right? You know what I learned from David? Nobody is too good for any sin. Could the situations be just right or just wrong so that a good Christian person could commit murder? It might be. In your line of work, have you seen good people do horrible things? In my line of work, I've met with good people who did horrible things. And you know why it happened? because they put themselves in a position for it to happen. And one thing led to another. That's how it works. A Christian is financially in trouble, and they work at a bank, and so they start taking a little bit, right? Well, then they take a little bit more, and then they take a little bit more, but then they're about to get caught, so they start having to go to extreme measures to protect themselves, right? Because I'm protecting my... See, just one thing leads to another. A man sees a woman, he lusts after her, he has an affair with her, she has a child, he tries to cover it up, ends up killing her husband. Does that sound familiar? Where'd that happen? David, a man after God's own heart. Since it can happen to anybody, I better be careful, right? And when that is vilified, we live in an upside-down world. So it's our job to pull even closer to Jesus and recognize that He is capable to deliver us. And that's the Jesus of Revelation. Comments or questions?
I always tell everybody that they start giving all these big speeches on Revelation, you know, how this is prophecy coming true. Let them look at verse 1.
Things which must... Things which must
Revelation of
shortly
Jesus Christ and things which come shortly.
John clears it all up in the first chapter, the first verse of the first chapter. Things which must shortly come to pass. Most of these things are going to take place in a time that's relatively close to the first century. And he signified them. That means he sent them in signs and symbols. It's highly symbolic stuff that was going to happen pretty soon to the time it was written. Anything else?